How does the work you do directly impact the fleet? On today's Airwaves podcast, you're going to meet a team that answered an urgent call from the front lines. Through teamwork, communication, and creative thinking, they removed barriers to deliver a game-changing capability to four deployed forces in record time. Welcome to Airwaves, the official podcast of the Naval Air Systems Command. I'm your host, Michael Lauren Prue. And joining me today virtually, we have team members from both the East and West Coast here to talk about this truly collaborative effort. Please welcome to the show from PMA 265 Program Manager Captain Michael Burks, Military Class Desk Lieutenant Commander Zach Fisher, and Weapons Systems Integration Lead Engineer Jenna Rosebrock. And from NOCWD China Lake, Jill Patterson, AM9X Sidewinder Technical Project Office Director. Thank you all for joining us. Now, Captain Burks, before we talk about this specific effort, let's talk about the program office. Tell us about PMA 265 and how the work you do supports the fleet.
Well, thanks first. Appreciate you having us and letting us tell our story and share a great moment of success for the program office. So first, PMA 265, what does that mean? We are the program office that supports the F-18 Super Hornet, the E-18 Growler, and the F-18, the A through D, what we now call the Legacy or the Classic Hornet, being flown by the Marines and also our FMS partners internationally. So our job here in the program office, our core mission statement is to support, sustain, and advance the fleet. We are the acquisition arm, so the procurement of new capability that we deliver the fleet. So not only at the platform level, but then at continuing to keep our aircraft modernized in order to be relevant against an advancing threat. So continuously modernizing our aircraft, working with industry to develop those designs, procure that capability, and then figuring out how to integrate that onto the platform out in the fleet. The second arm, as we talk about the sustainment of our aircraft in the fleet, thinking about what do we do to be able to enable maintenance, develop a maintenance plan, put technical publications in place, and then also be able to stand up the repair capability for all of the parts that break on the airplane. And then the last arm that we're going to talk mostly today is supporting the fleet, fielding those direct phone calls, those asks for help. How can we take some of the risk out of the risky operations that we're asking them to do, and then bring that back and own that through either a technical assessment or a risk assessment in order to make their lives easier.
And as you mentioned on today's podcast, we are talking about fielding a capability in direct support of the fleet. So, Captain, what was the request?
The urgent need that came from the forward deployed unit. Currently, we know over in the 5th Fleet area of operations that the Houthi rebels are trying to attack merchant and naval vessels, and they're really challenging freedom of navigation. So that's core mission as a Navy in order to be able to ensure freedom of navigation. And that's currently being challenged in the Red Sea. And so the ask here was really for increase in operational capability for their F-18s that are flying in support of that mission. So they asked us for a specific new weapons loadout for the platform that currently wasn't authorized. And so that's what set up the challenge into the program office to understand if we could provide them that increased weapons loadout that was going to enable them to do that mission and enable the freedom of navigation through that area to be done more seamlessly and make them much more effective at their mission.
And so once you received that request, Lieutenant Commander Fisher, how did the team respond?
And so the request came because of some prior work that was done that was known out of the fleet that we had done something similar. And so they asked the question. We basically looked across the board and found that it was something that we could do with a certain amount of risk. And so we basically saw if it was feasible. Once we realized that it's something we could do with a mitigated risk posture, we went and we started looking at everything that was similar. And so we looked at things that had been done before, and we started there from what we knew. And then we brought everybody together. So we pulled in different disciplines that we thought were necessary. They pulled in different people that they thought were necessary. And we just slowly built the team and aligned.
So you mentioned bringing in everyone. Tell me who was involved and who were some of the key stakeholders.
Yeah, so there are a lot of people that are in play when we clear a weapon for a platform. So we had people from TICOM, from CNAV, from the gun boss, so kind of that side of the house. But then within Nav Air, we also had all of our SMEs on the airworthiness side for the platform and for the weapon itself. So that was 20 or so SMEs that had to react and react quickly in order to get a flight clearance through the system. That is challenging. Typically, flight clearances take a month or more, and that's when we are ready and prepared to process a flight clearance. So when we were given the challenge to clear it within a week, I think everybody understood the urgency and were willing to get on board in the line. But there were a lot of phone calls and a lot of text messages to a lot of people from multiple disciplines. Lots of tech domains had to be engaged and to approve that flight clearance. So I just want to give kudos to our SMEs, because not only were they willing to work overtime and react, but they were professional and did it quickly. And then we had a lot of other stakeholders that we had to reach out to and people we didn't even know we needed to talk to. So yeah, it was a big effort across Nav Air and a lot of other entities.
How did you get everyone aligned to the same goal?
It started with understanding the importance of the need. I guess it helped that it was seen in the news as far as the operationally in the fleet, what they were doing. There was no funded written requirement when we started. PMA-225 started technically at risk with PMA-259 and TPO. And we had to slowly onboard other stakeholders. And then once the requirement came, we were ready though. And it was basically just mission alignment. And then once everybody realized how important it was after talking to fleet stakeholders a little back and forth, it was very easy to get everybody on the same page.
And I'll just jump in here real quick and just say, if we just went business as usual, we know that this probably would have been a 1 month best case, maybe 2 months, 3 months is how the standard flow of this work goes. It was a audacious goal to throw out, let's see if we can do it in 7 days, you know, and there wasn't a hard demand to have it in 7 days, you know, that the fleet was asking to go as fast as possible. And I think just our connection to the mission, the understanding of how important this was, and the understanding that there were real lives at risk that potentially we could have an impact on, made it easy to say, let's try to do this in a completely different fashion. Let's look at it through a fresh lens. Let's try to get it done in 7 days. And I remember Fab on day two came and asked me as we were approaching, I think it was midday Friday, and said, hey, is this something we need to ask people to work over the weekend for? And said, absolutely, right? There are combat ops going on. There are attacks underway right now. If we can get this capability out, it's going to help have a huge impact on that freedom of navigation mission. So absolutely, this is where we pull out all the stops. So we've been spending a lot of time thinking about how we prepare ourselves in this organization and Nav Air for a wartime footing, mostly focused on other bigger conflicts. But this was a little bit almost of a training ground. And we took that approach of how do we prepare ourselves to be ready to be absolutely responsive to the fleet in the time of conflict. And this was an easy one to connect the workforce to.
And I can imagine while moving fast and thinking and doing things differently, there had to be a sense of trust. How did you build trust amongst the teams?
Good relationships breed trust. And so at first, I don't know that it was there. I don't know that it wasn't there. But after talking to the different stakeholders and disciplines, it became clear that we were building trust amongst the team. And so it just took conversations. It took alignment. It took small wins. So us executing our end at the program office and different stakeholders executing their ends, that builds trust, and that helped along the way. And then when we had subject matter experts weigh in, we respected their thoughts, their guidance. You build the relationship, you build the respect, and you build the trust between people. And at the end of the day, it's a people business. And because of that, because we were aligned to being on the same team, there was, I guess, some inherent trust built in.
I think we were sort of lucky in this particular situation because a lot of that trust had already been developed. So for me personally, I had come from PMA 259, so I already had a lot of those relationships with those SMEs and the TPO and the program office. So there was a basis of trust to begin with, which I think really helped us. There was not a huge learning curve on the airworthiness side, but there was still a lot of trust outside of Nav Air that really did have to be developed. There were relationships that solidified during this process, but there were some pre-existing ones that really helped us to move fast.
Absolutely. There is just so much value in building those relationships. Now, Jenna, what would you say was unique or different about this effort? And as you moved through the process, how did you encourage the team to innovate, think differently, or embrace a new way of doing things?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is really just the communication and people's willingness to react and not put up roadblocks. And also, we knew that we had leadership support. We knew that Captain Burks would have our back if we did something or if we did something out of alignment because we were trying to move fast. And we knew that if there were risks identified, that people at the right levels were willing to take those risks. So I think it was the mindset of we knew this was important and we also knew we had the backing to make it happen. I think that combination really is what made us successful.
Lieutenant Commander Fisher, what would you say from your perspective enabled the team to go fast?
The requirement coming from the fleet, the mindset, and then people knocking down those barriers. Really, it was Captain Burks and leadership at PMA 259. They reiterated the importance of it and the importance of what we do. And then with that, it allows people just to get the job done. Instead of asking how long does it normally take to do this, we asked how long will it take to do this? And we did what we could with the information that we had and the time that we felt we needed to do it, because everybody was aligned and saying that we needed to go do this. And so that really helped us.
Were there any challenges associated to speeding up the process?
Going fast is great, and we need to go fast. At the same time, there's times where we might have gone too fast in areas, and we learned from it. And so getting documentation out prematurely with a flight clearance happened once. We didn't have some other documentation that could have informed that clearance, so we had to do a rewrite. And so the idea of slow, smooth, smooth is fast helped us for follow-on iterations of this. And so fast is good, but fast and accurate is better.
Captain Burks, let's talk about the PMA 265 team. What behaviors would you say contributed to the success of this project?
I would say behaviors that I saw, observed, and we've been working to really instill within the PMA and all across NAVAIR is just understanding why we're in this business and our connection to mission overall. This ask was easy, came directly from the fleet through personal relationships. And so we took the approach of start with the warfighter first, understanding that it was time to kind of reprioritize workload, put this at the top of the list for everybody, and then focus on the outcome that matters to the fleet, right? And so that is a NAVAIR guiding principle. Let's focus on outcomes that matter to the fleet or matter to the warfighter. And so when you act that way, when you use that as your guiding principle in order to build your team, it helps really break down barriers, right? It stops the business as usual. It stops the bureaucracy that we feel that can build in a heavy process-oriented organization like NAVAIR. This is a complex business that we're in. We're in a business of ensuring safety and making sure that we understand technical risk. So we all want to go fast. I think everybody wants to go fast, but we want to do it with due diligence to make sure that we are doing the right things. And so I think just being able to connect with people and tell them the why up front and let them understand the potential outcome of getting to the yes or of completing the task or getting to work and connecting it really helped motivate people to potentially do things a different way than they had in the past.
And Jill, from the side of the technical project office, what behaviors do you think enabled the team's success?
So one of the things that I think really helped the TPO and the SMEs support PMA 265 and this fleet request was the behaviors of strong communication and being willing to be radically transparent in what they needed, why they needed it, questions that they had specifically on our SME recommendations. There was no ulterior motive in mind, or there was no perception of distrust. And those behaviors really encouraged the team to continue to press forward and use information that was similar, but not exact, and not normally what they would prefer to use to make these kind of recommendations, but that they felt comfortable enough doing.
All right, so earlier we were talking about data. Jenna, how did being data informed help you reach the best solution?
Yeah, so we had a lot of existing data. We had collected environmental data on the growler. So we had quite a bit of data in-house, but the challenge here was applying that to a new situation, which typically makes our SMEs very uncomfortable. But the fact that we had that there and they had data on other weapons systems and they could use their engineering judgment and be allowed to use their engineering judgment to not only provide airworthiness evidence, but also provide the recommendation on risk, really was instrumental in getting us across the line here. We were data driven, but we did have to go outside of the data that we had, and we did have to use engineering judgment. And we really did rely on our SMEs to make that assessment. And a lot of times we question and challenge our technical SMEs, but in this case, we embraced what they said and we moved forward with it. So I think that also was trust and transparency that we were willing to listen to their response and then acknowledge and move forward with that.
Yeah, you really were willing to give them the space to and the time to make the decisions that they needed to make to feel comfortable with the recommendations. There wasn't a lot of, hey, do you have an answer yet? You know, which we sometimes can get into when we have an urgent, pressing need.
How have the lessons learned from this project changed how you do business moving forward?
We learn a lot in the short period of time that we are with the organization, but when we move on, when others move on, a lot of that stuff, the information and knowledge goes with them. So we did it a little bit differently this time. We debriefed the event. So we had a hot wash with all the stakeholders from across the enterprise. We debriefed it, wrote up a lessons learned document, and that could be passed down to follow on teams doing something similar or maybe the same thing. In that, we put the big picture. And so a lot of times we're focused on doing our part, our job. And there's a lot of us that didn't see the whole picture of what needed to be done across the enterprise to be successful in this. And so I think it was a case study in that and understanding the whole picture and commander's intent down to the lowest level and understanding that everyone's aligned to the same goal. And that goes along with the trust. I think it also served as a lesson in capability agility. We dropped a lot of stuff that we're doing to get this done. And we were lucky that we had the data to do it. And that might not be the case in the future. Moving forward, learning the lesson of, you know, we need to have a collective understanding of the required timelines, previous work done, what work needs to be done at every single level. And we actually went and used this for a follow-on request that was seemingly maybe more technically difficult. We got a clearance out in 4 days, just basically with the using the relationships that we had built and understanding of everything that goes into executing a flight clearance for a new capability. So with this one, I thought that it was just the flight clearance, but there wasn't just the flight clearance. There's validation and verification checks that had to be done. There was the air launch bulletin that had to be done. There was the hazard analysis report and the system safety risk assessment. There was all sorts of things and products that had to contribute to this. So at the lowest level, I think if we understand all of that, we kind of know where we fit, but we know who we need to bring in or who to tell and who to rely on. I think that in the future, it'll be more of a collective mindset like it was with the most recent clearance that we just accomplished.
So I know you might be repeating a little bit on this from some of the stuff that we've already talked about through the podcast, but as you moved through the process, what were some of the biggest challenges or obstacles you encountered? And then how did you overcome them?
Our biggest challenges were really just talking and communicating and getting people aligned, getting so many people to move in the same direction and do that quickly. And then also, as a part of this, we circumvented some steps that we probably don't need to do. So like that was the other part, is we didn't necessarily follow everything to the T. We followed it from an airworthiness and technical perspective, but we were willing to make sacrifices and do things quickly and take text message like concurrences on a flight clearance, which we would not normally, we'd want it in the tool and through the process. And I think that was really great that we showed we had flexibility with a process that is very rigorous.
I just want to add that we're up against some systemic obstacles. And so in the future, how do we make changes? We're so good at designing technical systems and we make updates to it. We make software updates, hardware updates. We have all these systems to do it, but we're not very good, in my opinion, of making updates to the human systems that we have in place. And people are very by the book, which is great. That stuff is written for a reason, but it should be modified when it needs to be. It shouldn't be so hard to make those changes. And so I think systemic obstacles as well.
Absolutely. So Captain Burks, why do we need to have a sense of urgency in everything that we do?
it starts with the warfighter, and it is absolutely core to our mission, making sure that our sailors and our Marines have the absolute best capability that they have, that they can do their jobs with a limited amount of risk, that we make sure that the products that we deliver to them, the aircraft that they're flying, are as absolutely lethal and survivable as possible. And those that are paying close attention to the news know very well that the Navy is preparing itself for future major conflict in the case that that may happen. We are talking a lot about what we need to do, how we need to think, act, and operate differently in time of a major conflict in order to support our forward deployed forces who are out there. So that's our perspective. This was an absolute great evolution to do some learning, as Fab talked about, and team did a great job of, after it was done, reflecting, writing down some lessons learned. Now we need to figure out how we actually push those out across the organization. So I have utmost confidence that if this team is called again, they'll know exactly how to respond. And as Fab alluded to, the fleet has called again several times since this first victory. So we have delivered on that success and even shown that we could go faster in many cases and handle these technical challenges. But Fab and Jenna and Jill will only be here in the program office for so long before they'll take their next opportunity somewhere else in the organization. So trying to figure out how we embody and inculcate these lessons learned into the fabric of who we are so that we don't have to learn them again in 3 or 4 years is where our head's at now.
Captain, if you had to identify some of those biggest lessons learned and ones that you hope to scale throughout the community, what would those be?
So I think it just starts with the behaviors. It's being responsive. It's taking ownership of the outcome. It's driving change. It's not accepting business as usual or just the norms. It's challenging status quo. And really, more than anything, it's building teams, it's building relationships, it's the trust that we talked about earlier on. In order to encourage people, connect them to the why, connect them to the mission, show them the outcome that we will be able to achieve if we can work together. So that teaming process, I know, is what enabled success in this case and in those subsequent cases that I mentioned before.
And of course, earlier you mentioned the value of having that connection directly to the warfighter and to the fleet. Why is that so important?
Ultimately, that's what our organization exists for. That is the purpose of NAVAIR. That is the purpose of the PEO. That's the purpose of PMA 265, is to deliver that capability to the warfighter. And so we are a largely civilian organization, but we do have folks like myself that, especially as the program manager and the guy here wearing the flight suit, my core responsibility to connect the team, to show them what we need to do to support the fleet, but also to help articulate the why the fleet are asking for some of these things that are hard to deliver and challenge our organization.
So we hear a big push across the Naval Aviation Enterprise for everyone to get real, get better. Captain, I'd love to hear what that really means to you and to your team.
Yeah, so maybe I'll start and then I'll ask some of our other teammates here to jump in. So get real, get better, much more than just a buzzword. It's a culture that we're trying to build. Being thoughtful and reflective in all that we're doing, understanding whether we are actually connected and delivering the outcomes that we want to. And where we're not, recognizing that we are going to fall short in some areas, and we need, just to bring the word transparency back up again, we need full transparency of where we're underperforming, where we're not achieving our goals. We talk about embracing the red, elevating barriers. Those are all the behaviors that enable us to critically self-assess, to become that learning organization, to share where we are and what it's going to take for us to get better. So, maybe I'll turn it over to either Fab or Jenna or Jill and see their thoughts on get real, get better.
Get real, get better is about that empowerment. Being empowered to fix the problems, to be bold, to be making decisions at the lowest level where it's most appropriate, and to really accelerate to the warfighter the things that they need now, right? And we can't do that if we're not empowering our subject matter experts to provide you the information and the fleet, the things that they need.
To me, it means authenticity and drive. Having the drive to make ourselves better. to make our organization better and to make what we do better. If we're being authentic and we can objectively look at ourselves to make ourselves better, and then we can inspire others to do the same. You inspire enough people and you create an authentic organization, and you can't do that without drive. It's easy to say, hey, look, there's a problem. That's being authentic. There is a problem. But if we don't have the drive to fix it, then it doesn't matter. And so to me personally, getting real and getting better is exactly kind of what it says. Get real and then do what you need to do to get better. Ask the questions. Use the data-driven tools that are provided by Big Navy or leadership or whoever else. If something didn't go well with a conversation or a meeting, we can look back and ask why it didn't go well and how we could make those interactions better. And then with better interactions, we likely have better outcomes. And then if we look at why evolutions didn't go well, if we look at those with data and using the same mechanisms and we revise them, we'll make them better.
Yeah, I'll add on. So I will echo what both Jill and Fab have said. Authenticity and decisiveness are both really key to getting real and getting better. This particular effort was really challenging for me. I like to do my due diligence and research and before I ask a question. And Fab really pushed me to be decisive and do things quickly. So I think that is a lot of what we need to do. Maybe not hem and haw and think about things too long. There were points in this effort where I didn't know if I really had the authority to tell somebody else to go do something. And Fab was like, do it, just go. And so those sorts of decisiveness and giving people confidence to do what they need to do in order to move the ball really is part of that get real, get better. I personally think that's what I've learned from this particular effort. And then trying to scale that will be a challenge because a lot of our programs take years. But to try to have that mindset every day of like, let's just get something done today, decide something and move a little bit closer to the goal. Some urgency is really important.
All right. So as we wrap today's podcast, what about this effort are you the most proud of, Captain?
For me, what I'm most proud of is the behaviors that the team has taken on and the learning and the willingness to maybe live outside of their comfort zone a little bit, as I think you've heard here. So not only was this specific project an individual success, we've already alluded to it. There were a couple more phone calls that have already come in right after from the fleet asking for more as a follow-up to this specific weapons loadout that they were looking for, but also another technical challenge that they came in the ask of trying to land the aircraft at a heavier gross weight than we traditionally do. And we were able to use the learning from this first iteration to go even faster on the second one. So that shows me the learning that was taken on, the fact that we were just embodying those behaviors and those principles of supporting the fleet and starting with the warfighter, delivering the outcomes right from the get-go. And then, of course, the teaming that had been built, the teaming, the relationships, and the trust to be able to deliver the second ask and the third ask. That's what I'm most proud of.
So for me, I being out in the fleet on deployment, having stuff not work or needing something, it was real easy to say, darn it, Navair, whoever you are, because I didn't know who they were at the time years ago. And then actually being it and now understanding it, it was kind of like, I've learned a lot. And now being able to spread that knowledge and understanding, because the fleet understands what we do more, they know they can ask better questions. There's more trust there because there's a trust thing between the fleet and Navair. So building that and then getting them what they needed was great. For me, it was a proud moment for the program office. And the cohesiveness between the groups, the shops, if you will, of the program office, the integrated product teams, and just the different engineering organizations and niches is like, man, this feels more like a squadron. And so I feel like there was a sense of, for me, pride in the program office after this whole evolution.
What advice would you have for other teams facing similar challenges or opportunities?
Don't do it in a stovepipe. Everybody's got the same problems. To humble yourself and get out there, ask the questions. And then when you do solve a problem, don't just keep it to yourself. Help everyone else.
And find the yes if, right? There's a lot of hard questions and the easy answer is always no. But if you can find the yes if, you can move forward and you can move fast.
All right, so get out there and find the yes if. What a perfect way to end today's podcast. Thank you all so much for joining us. to talk about this effort and how the team employed Get Real, Get Better principles and behaviors to think differently and remove barriers to deliver a game-changing capability to Ford deployed forces in record time. Of course, if you'd like to hear more Get Real, Get Better efforts going on around the command, check out the Airwaves podcast on all your favorite listening apps. And that's it for this edition of Airwaves. Thanks for listening.